The views expressed in our episode are ours alone and do not represent any other organizations. Our episodes discuss internet crimes against children and cases that involve the exploitation of children and may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do. We don't want to scare anybody.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Catfish Cops. My name is Brandon Poor.
My name is Tony Godwin.
And welcome back. We have been, hopefully, you have been enjoying listening to several of the episodes dealing with our Crimes Against Children recordings, with our interview with Derek, with Jared. We've got some fun interviews coming up. Hopefully, this will be a great, refreshing respite from the
respite.
Right. You like that? Interviews that we've done, because today we're actually doing a case study. We are going to bring you some exciting guest appearances. Okay. Let me just tell you, Tony, please chime in here. But I think we've been trying to get this guest on for 3 years,
three and a half years. Very long time. There were some, they were unable to come on to the podcast because of the work at the time, the active status of the work.
Yep.
And so
who she worked for.
And there were some limitations with that. But effective
November.
November
22nd, I think, was the
November
date.
2023, officially retired from the Federal Bureau of Investigations from the FBI.
Welcome, Jennifer Mulliken.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh. I'm so excited to have you on here. She's blushing. You know, we are literally in another part of the country training right now as we speak.
Yep.
And it took an act of Congress to get Jen into this podcast studio to talk about things on the podcast. And our hope is, as we do a few episodes of case studies, that she will be our third guest host and just be a commentator on the side. She's really nervous about her voice right now because she's been sick. So I'm putting that out there, and you don't
sound like a rock star. It doesn't matter if it sounds a little sketchy, then I'm just going to amp it up a little bit in the little software.
It won't be sketchy. We have tried so hard. You know, it literally, I mean, I think we had to bribe. No, we didn't bribe her. That sounds, we'll cut that out. No, we had to literally like drag her into talk on here. So we're excited to have you.
Thank you. I am excited to be here.
No, you're not. Not even a little bit. She's such a good liar. Tell us, who are you? Who is Jennifer? Yeah,
give us some background. Like, how long?
Start at the beginning. It was a dark and stormy night. Your mother was in a lot of pain, but you were charging through. No, let's not go back that far. Let's go to how did you get into law enforcement? And because we want to talk about what you've done for 20 years, but let's start before that and how you got into it.
So I told my parents when I was a teenager that I was going to be an FBI agent.
Really?
Really.
Like early teens or?
I think 15, 16. Wow. After watching the X-Files.
So it's a TV show.
So I told my parents I was going to be an FBI agent, and then went to A&M, graduated, moved to Houston, did stuff in pharmaceuticals.
What did they say when you said, I want to be an FBI agent? Were they like, yes, or, okay, she'll forget about this?
Encouraging. They said, of course, you could be whatever you want to be.
Oh, okay. Yes. Knowing that, okay, she won't be an FBI agent, but.
And then Houston, I worked pharmaceuticals for 6 years and the hours were crazy. And I said, I don't want to work like that. So I applied to the Bureau and I applied in October of 2002. I applied in February of 2003 and I was there in October of 2003.
Wow. And
that's a quick turnaround.
Yes.
That's right after 9/11, of course. And did that factor in? Did you have, as far as like, was that any sort of play into when you joined or, you know, because I know a lot of people join law enforcement after 9/11 for that feeling of serving and.
No, I just knew I was about to turn 30. And that if I didn't do it, you know, pull the trigger and do it, then I wasn't going to do it.
So what time. What is, is the age that you joined is probably not very common, right? I guess it's maybe is the element that's applying for FBI, are they often younger or are they?
I think the average of at the time when I went through, it was 28.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah. So at the time I went through, you had to have 3 years of full-time work experience. So you graduate college, that puts you 24, 25, depends on when you graduate college, the soonest that you could apply.
So physically, like tell our listeners, we have a lot of listeners, a lot of moms with kiddos and a lot of real faithful people that listen that are outside law enforcement. Like what's the real skinny is how hard is the FBI Academy? Difficult?
I hated it. I've been back once. Never want to go back. It was brutal. Christmas Eve, wow. I was neck deep doing like in Lake Lunga, which later on they decided had live ordinances in it. So we shouldn't have been running through it. But Christmas Eve, from noon to two, our fit instructor decided to do what we would call a point run, where you run, you drop down and you do sit-ups and push-ups. You run, you drop down, you do whatever other exercise. Christmas Eve, he did that to us.
And how long is the academy for FBI?
When I went through, it was 16 weeks, but I was 17 because I hit Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Oh, so they give you those breaks to go see family or
but
whatever.
But now I think it's 20 weeks.
Wow.
So they've added terrorism and classes in it. So I think it's 20 weeks now.
But wow. It is I think people are used to hearing us talk about law enforcement and cop stuff in general. But I don't think we've had FBI on. And what's the, like you come out as an FBI agent, you know, having learned just everything about investigation, right? Like what do people think? I know what people think when they think FBI agent. What is an FBI agent coming out ready to do?
So you'll be assigned to a squad. So they teach you the basics, the who, what, when, where, why, how, and how to do, you know, an investigation. Start by asking them basic questions. But I think the biggest thing the academy teaches you, right, especially right now, is the agents go through with the intel analysts. And so they learn like what the street agent does and then what intel can bring to you as an investigator. We also learned evidence response, which is the basic way to collect the evidence and keep it secure for trial and presentation. So you learn all that fundamentally. And then when you get to your field office, you're on probation for 2 years, 1 or 2 years. Cause I think if you have military background, or a law enforcement background, you may be on probation for a year, but 1 or 2 years on probation and you're supposed to learn a lot or most of what you get from your training agent.
Do they along through the basic, you know, investigative stuff, they teach you the basics. Are you sort of teased with what sort of groups or squads are out there that potential work you could go and do and get assigned to? Where they, do they try to fit a niche? You know what I mean? Like, do they see, oh, you might have a propensity to do well in kid crimes or in financial or fraud or this or that? Or is it just random? Hey, you're going to this place and here's where there's a need.
So it's the field office. So, like I said, I was 16 weeks. I think it was week 7. We got our orders. They give you a list. There's 56 FBI field offices. One where you want to go, 56. God, no, I don't want to go there. And then we call it the drunk monkey. They throw a dart at it. And literally, they just pick where you go. And then it's your field office that determines where the agent goes. So once you get assigned a field office, then they send a packet down to that field office and executive management would look at the packet and say, okay, this is this agent's background. Where would that agent fit best in our program or in our field office?
So of course you can always say, I don't really want to talk about that on here if you have a question that you don't want to answer, but can you tell us when you came out, what field office you went to? What was your niche coming out of the academy?
So at week 7, I was assigned to the New Orleans field office. And then I think it was a couple weeks later, I found out that I was going to the Baton Rouge Resident Agency, which at the time had maybe 10 agents.
Were you, you didn't have any background in Louisiana or, but no. Did you have ties to Baton Rouge or it was literally just you're going there because
so
that's
I had
where we
processed
need you.
Out of Houston. So I looked at a map and said, where are the closest field offices to Texas?
Yeah.
And I got New Orleans and then they sent me to Baton Rouge and Baton Rouge didn't have squads. So you worked whatever came in. If you were the only agent in the office and healthcare fraud case walked through the door,
yeah,
it was your case.
So break that down. Like a bigger city like New Orleans or New York or LA or Detroit, Dallas, they have separate squads that handle certain types of crimes. Correct. But where you went, you called it a RA or
it's a resident agency.
Resident agency. So that's whatever comes through the door then.
Correct. And gotcha. So I had a training agent there, and what he did is pretty much what any agent in the office, whenever they had a search warrant, they were going to go do an interview, I got paired with them. But they also sent me back to New Orleans for a week, and I had to spend a day with certain squads. So I was there for a week, and Monday morning I was with the violent crime squad. You know, Tuesday I was with so-and-so squad. So you get a taste of the squads then.
And that's just to give you the experience to go with different squads and see what I guess later they can evaluate and say, oh yeah, you kind of did really well here, or you kind of blew this up or didn't do well.
Correct. It's just kind of like, here's a little bit of what you can do in the bureau. You're at a small office, you're going to work whatever. And then when I transferred to Dallas after a few years, I was put on public corruption. And I worked public corruption for 6 years, but they knew I had a background in crimes against children because I was undercover certified while I was in Baton Rouge.
Okay, wait. We got to go back.
Okay.
So Baton Rouge, you're doing the everything that comes in. Mm-hmm. And how did you get a background in crimes against children?
I was voluntold that I needed
as
to,
most of us are,
no. That I needed to go get training in BCAC, violent crimes against children, and become undercover certified. So at that point, Hurricane Katrina had hit a little bit before that. And they told me I wasn't transferring. The Bureau had a policy that if you went to a small or medium office, you had to transfer at 3 years. Mm. So New Orleans was a small to medium office. So I was expected to transfer after 3 years. Well, then Hurricane Katrina hit and they said, you're not going anywhere. You're going to get training to be VCAC certified. So I did that. And then I get back and they said, just kidding, you're transferring. So I transferred a year later. So I transferred at 4 years instead of three. So I did very little VCAC under Tom Tedder, who was basically the television or the HBO series. True Detective.
Yeah.
That first episode was about his casework. So I learned under him for a few months.
Now, we haven't mentioned him before on here. Awesome. He's fantastic. One of my favorite people out there. And the characters aren't based on him, but the case was his work that he did. Correct. So I make, you know, little jokes to him every once in a while about that show and ask him which character he is. And he's like, no, that's not me. But that was his casework. And that was your trainer, right?
He was for the violent crimes against children. Yes.
And my gosh, what a training agent to have.
Good place to cut your teeth, you know, someone that's done stuff like that. And so when you fast forward a little and said you were moved to Dallas. And so tell us about that. You said you automatically get placed somewhere after usually 3 years, but you were 4 years. Did you have a say or a choice of saying, hey, I'd like to go to Dallas or I'd like to go to Houston because, you know, we know you're Texas based.
So at that time, they give you a list of the top 17 offices and you get to pick from the top 17. And again, one is where you really want to go. 17 is where you don't want to go.
So one was what?
Houston.
And then
Dallas was two.
Dallas was two. Oh, so
but because I had processed out of Houston, I don't think they were pretty keen on sending me back to Houston.
Yeah.
But no complaints about Dallas at all.
Yeah. You come into Dallas and you're Dallas FBI starting in what squad?
A public corruption. So at the time I transferred, Dallas did not have a violent crimes against children squad. There were two agents working crimes against children on a violent crime task force.
Okay. What does public corruption deal with? I think it sounds self-explanatory, but like people are thinking, what does public corruption in FBI look like?
Public corruption is investigating city officials, investigating bad cops, mm-hmm. Cases like that.
So you had to have been loved when you came to
I actually was. Working bad cops was very tough, but most cops do not want a bad apple in their agency.
100%.
And so when they learned that you are a fair agent, mm-hmm. And that you were going to conduct an investigation to prove somebody guilty, but also to prove them innocent in the same stead. So I worked very closely with a lot of agencies and, you know, I think they were open to me coming in and conducting an investigation because they knew I'd be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've mentioned that before, even when we talk about our own specific case studies in ICAC, where when we are looking at a specific offender, like we work as hard, if not harder, to disprove anything as we are proving up a criminal case, you know, because one, it's what needs to happen. That's the thoroughness of a case. And sometimes, you know, you have those instances where people have been accused of stuff or they haven't done it, or more often they have done it and there's overwhelming evidence to do that. So I know for us from a, you know, law enforcement standpoint, like I'm all for it. If you got a bad, crooked cop, you absolutely need to investigate them and put them exactly where they need to go, because it's just a bad dude or a bad gal with a badge and gives us all a bad name. Yeah. So
how long on public corruption? You said 6 years?
6 years.
And then how do you get to violent crimes against children, VCAC, from public corruption?
So at the time, they were creating the Child Exploitation Task Force, and one of the individuals that was working crimes against children knew I had a crimes against children background. And so when they were creating the task force, she suggested my name, and I was selected to be on the Child Exploitation Task Force.
Was that welcome? Like, was that something you were like, yeah, I want to do that? Or was it like, okay, I will, but you weren't looking for that necessarily? Or was that something that was interesting to you?
It was definitely welcome, because I think working cases on behalf of children is the most fulfilling work you could work.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was tired of public corruption.
Right.
It is.
That's got to wear on you, I would imagine.
And then you have a lot of input from headquarters, which makes it difficult to not be able to make decisions on your cases without input from a lot of people. So I was ready to be done working public corruption.
But then you go into VCAC.
And I go into VCAC.
And makes history. So, you know, we're acting very formal and asking these formal questions about your background, but we happen to have worked with Jennifer for like
many, many years.
40 years, it feels like, 50 years that we've worked together. Tony longer than I, I think 3 years or 4 years longer than I have.
So I've been working crimes against children for 11 years. And I think I was working with Tony for 10 years and 10 months or something.
Yeah. At least, from the beginning. Right from the beginning. And I at the time had kind of dabbled and been courted, I guess, to do the TFO thing for FBI back then. And there was just some semantics with, you know, how it was done then versus how it's done now. And it was just something. It was never a position that my own agency wanted to cough me up, you know, 5 days a week, that kind of thing. But the beauty of it was we still had this great working relationship and, you know, got to make a ton of cases together over the time, which has been great fun. And I know we've, you know, Brandon sort of alluded, but we're kind of treating this so you guys have the benefit of understanding, but like they broke the mold with Jen Mulliken. She works at a pace and speed and ability like anybody we would ever expect to go into law enforcement who just has a heart and a passion for the job to do this and to do it right.
And a lot of cops think Jen was a cop before she became FBI.
Yeah.
People think that and ask you that. And I mean, I know she's sitting here shaking her head. The reason that they ask that is because they think, well, clearly you had to have been law enforcement before because you're such a cop. You're such an investigator and you're a cop's cop kind of person. And so that's a huge compliment, I think, when people say, you know, where did you work before FBI law enforcement wise? Just today, someone asked, like, you were a cop first. And she's like, no, I was FBI. And they're amazed because they, you know, a lot of people, I think it's a compliment from a cop to say, like, you seem like you were somewhere else before FBI. I know we've got a lot to talk about. You have a lot. What do you remember your first case at VCAC FBI in Dallas? Do you remember like what kind of case it was? Cause I want to talk about all the types of cases you've worked, how you got into sort of the stuff you did most. And you know, like this is going to be we're going to be here a while. Let's talk.
Yeah. I don't remember my very first case. I know when I got on the squad, there was tons of work to do, and that's why they had created the task force. But I don't remember my very first case.
But what is VCAC work? Like, let's open there. What is VCAC? What falls under the FBI? Because I think a lot of people have asked that too. Like, what makes it federal or state, or what gets the FBI involved versus, you know, my local agency, or, you know, those are the questions I think people are wanting to know about these kinds of cases.
So what works, the violent crimes against children for us is has to be an interstate nexus.
What does that mean?
And most people think that it has to cross state lines.
Yeah.
Or the activity has to cross state lines. No, it has to be whether it's the internet. The internet's the interstate nexus in most of our cases. But if not that, computers, cell phones, anything like that that's not manufactured in the state of Texas would give FBI a nexus to.
Which is pretty much every single solid case there is, because as far as I know, there's not one cell phone produced in the state of Texas that I'm aware of.
Not that I know of.
And if there is,
used in a lot of them.
Yeah, the internet's used in a bunch. So, you know, the connection to make the nexus to the feds is super easy. Now, it's a little intimidating from where we stand on the civilian side, I guess, or the law enforcement side that we're on, being certified by the state, is because you don't really know in the beginning of like what that's like. And so that's why I think that's so unique to have you here now be able to talk to us, because it speaks volumes as to how that relationship gets built between feds and locals, state locals, tribal and all that. And what the benefit is. It seems very intimidating when it's, you're from our side looking over and you're like, ooh, crap, I don't know how to do any of that. And that seems like a lot of work. And, but then when you see it, and especially the way you did things and explained it very simply, and you know, it's just terminology changes and things like that. But,
and you're the spokesperson for federal local partnership. Like that is your passion.
Amen.
Yeah. And so 100%. Talk, what does that look like? Cause it sounds like even in public corruption, you worked very closely with agencies, but I know having worked the last 8 years with you that it's like your bread and butter is liaison work with local agencies and partnering with local agencies.
Absolutely. That was something that I was told in one of my trainings up at Quantico, that, wherever you were sent as an agent, I was told that your bread and butter was going to come from working relationships with your local partners. And that's 100%. Y'all know your cities better than I do. And so when I needed something in Garland or Grand Prairie, why would I reinvent the wheel when you guys were there and y'all had the
or
pulse
Dallas
on your
cities? Or Fort Worth or anywhere
Correct,
else, right?
Anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, quite honestly, it's just one of those deals where, you know, we don't know what we don't know. And if you, you know, from where we sit with our agencies, if we weren't trained by somebody that ever had an attachment, you know, to the feds, whatever fed agency, you know, they desired, you just didn't know. So there was always this sort of, not stigma, but more or less like, oh, that seems like a lot, or it'd be really difficult to do this. And then the reality is absolutely not. Like, that's what you guys do. Because think about it. If you are a listener of this podcast and you're a mom of a teenage child or a preteen child, and you encounter something, like, your first thought's not to go call FBI to make a notice of that. Now, there are certainly circumstances
Sometimes,
where that happens.
Right?
But far and few between, I think that more often than not, most people just call their local agency. And so they don't maybe talk about that. How would leads come? I mean, we know the importance of having the relationship with the locals, but how would a typical lead come, you know, for somebody where you were in VCAC on the Fed side? Is that a different, that's a, obviously a different kind of process of depending on what happens, or do you just strictly wait for the locals to bring?
No, we like the locals. We had cases where we worked, which were reactive. They were, you know, file sharing cases. We would get leads from other field offices based upon a case that they had that crossed into our territory. We would get leads from headquarters based upon whether it was an international case or a case from another state that connected to Dallas somehow, gotcha, some way. So we would get cases like that. It just so happened that when we developed relationships, I started looking at the cases that y'all were working. And I know when y'all came across cases that involve production on children, y'all would just charge it as a possession case, possession promotion. And I was like, wait a minute, that's a production in federal and we get a minimum of 15 years.
Yeah. What does that mean? What is a, like, define some things for our listeners. What is a production?
That's when an individual creates new images or videos depicting a minor victim.
Okay. So they are creating CSAM of a child, and producing those images or videos, right?
That is correct.
And so that gets a sentence a minimum sentence. That's the benefit, right? The feds have some minimum sentencing things.
Correct.
And you said 15 for a production.
15 to 30 is their sentencing guidelines.
Okay. And yeah. So that brings a little bit different outcome than some of the state guidelines, right? That the federal the federal liaison can bring, you know, working with you and federal partners.
Correct, because I noticed some of the sentences for that kind of activity, an individual who created new files involving a new child victim, were getting sentences that could be anywhere from a couple years to 5 years. And I think for a child victim that's being molested and documented via video or images, that's just too little of a sentence.
Yeah. And we've talked about that pretty extensively throughout many, many of our podcasts as to why we helped build or get these relationships built with the feds and why we chose to do that. It's just, for me, that's really what it's always been. I want to put these people away for the most amount of time I possibly can and make sure that they don't ever have the ability to do something to a child again.
Someone else, right?
And that's really what it's all about. It's about rescuing kids and saving kids and making sure that they're never having to go through something like that again from an offender who has this propensity. And so for me, and I know for Brandon, that's just why we formulated those relationships early on and all to the success, because
y'all
were
doing the work and finding the evidence. We just were able to put it into factors that made it a case to where we could get minimum sentences, whether it's the 5 years for sharing the child porn.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, child sexual abuse material. I know.
It's you're used to, you were working it before that terminology changed, right?
Yeah.
But still hasn't changed within our in FBI documentation, but federal filings, still child pornography.
In FBI documentation, it is CSAM.
Correct.
But in statutory language. But what does that look like? So you were saying, like, it's not just, you just don't come in and go, oh, thanks for the work, Tony,
right,
and take over, and now it's my case and I get all the glory. I'm saying that because I think some people think, oh, you just came in, took what he did and said, here you go. You do a lot on your side too. What does that look like when Tony says, hey, I've got a case, you come look at it? What do you do?
A lot of times Tony would contact me before they even ran the warrant so that I could be on scene to see exactly everything from the foundation. Yep. And while they're doing what they're trained to do, I'm looking kind of behind the scenes at stuff and like, how can I build the case to take it federal? Because y'all get records like cyber tips, which the FBI very rarely gets the cyber tips. FBI Dallas isn't looking at walking into an office on Monday and having 15 to 20 cyber tips to address.
Right.
So that was my goal, is to work the cases with the police departments. And if I can take some of that off of y'all, and these are great cases, why not do it?
And the benefit, you know, another benefit for us from the agencies that we work at is the resources that the feds have, and like the analysts that you have and the people that are doing so many other things, where from a staffing standpoint for us, you know, we've mentioned many times, like, I was on the island by myself for many, many years, and Brandon's on the island by himself. And so we often have to tap into resources internally within our own agencies and rely on the goodwill of our fellow coworkers to say, oh, hey, I know you're in the middle of this giant investigation.
You're really busy, but
could you drop that and come with us and go get this traveler guy or this gal or whatever it may be? And so to me, the other resources that you brought from FBI, aside from obviously the work ethic and just everything, it was just a great sort of like symbiotic feel, because you had the same passions that we have as to why we did this and doing it for the right reasons. And that's such a big thing. And we do have a lot of ICAC folks, cops, law enforcement all over the country and world for that matter that listen, and we want to break that, whatever stigma goes with it, right? Because no matter where we go, no matter where we travel, even where we are right now training, we see that there's a little stigma that comes with.
It's a little us versus them.
Yeah.
You know, sort of mentality of feds versus local, and I don't think it's intentional. I think there's a little bit of
ignorance almost.
Almost like misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and maybe for better or worse, there's that idea of like, you're going to come in and take over my case, and everything I've done, you're just going to take for yourself and make it your case, and then I'm left here. You know,
but we can say that's not the case at all. That doesn't happen. That's not how it happens. Like, and so I think this is a good way to bridge the sort of gap that maybe might lead to some of the misunderstanding about that. So it's good to clarify.
Yeah, I hope that doesn't happen because we've had so many years of great relationships, knowing what we both brought to the table. I would love to have other agencies develop those relationships with their federal partners because it's been so successful for us.
And one of your favorite resources to bring and talk about is the electronic detection canine, right?
Sweet Iris.
Oh, Jen. Okay, so if let's just tell some secrets about Jen. Jen loves and has her own little, her children, her four-legged children.
My fur babies.
Her fur babies. And she is nothing if not serious about those pups. And,
oh, yeah.
And, but she is also a huge proponent of the electronic detection canine. Talk about that. What is that?
So I'm a huge proponent, like Tony said, of utilizing the assets that we have. If you are going to take the time to run a search warrant, do your best on that search warrant.
Yeah.
And one of those things is bringing the correct team. The best of the best that you can, because children rely on us. Mm. And one of the things that I knew about, I knew the FBI had this asset, but I thought that we had to prove ahead of time that there were hidden devices. Mm. I quickly learned that was not correct. So I requested Iris and her handler, Agent Calandra, and I would never run a warrant without them. This is the most amazing dog, I think, I've ever seen
in the world.
In the world.
Yeah.
And the evidence that she has found.
Now, what does she do? Like that, I don't, some people may not even know this thing, that this is even an, this a exists.
Thing. A thing. Yeah.
So I love the dog, but getting into the technical, I don't want to misspeak, but,
no, her, just in general,
her job is basically to sniff out hidden electronics. And I say hidden, overlooked electronics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are executing search warrants in houses that have a lot of material in it, a lot of junk, and it's easy to miss small micro SD cards, SD cards, flash drives. And so she's kind of like the verification that goes behind us to make sure we don't miss anything.
Yeah. And having witnessed this personally, like, being someone who has searched a place, a location where we were executing a warrant and feeling very confident. And, you know, there's always questions like everybody wants to get dressed up and go to the dance, fancy pants, party socks, come to the dance, right? We exactly. want to kick the door. We want to do all the sexy stuff. But then you got to do the dirty work. You got to get your hands dirty and you got to search and you got to look through places that are just disgusting on every single level, hoarder extraordinaire. And remember that, and we've mentioned this many times before, but we have, you know, we're looking for sometimes things as smaller than a pencil eraser, you know, correct. A tiny micro SD card or something like that. And so it's very, very easy to overlook and miss things. And complacency gets the best of all of us in law enforcement across the board. So you drag people to a warrant who are there to help you, but you know, maybe they had a crappy night the night before and they're really not being very diligent and they're kind of just,
but you know what? Sometimes to be fair, sometimes I've seen people search.
Yeah.
And it's just, gosh, this is almost hiding in plain sight because it's like, it's so well, camouflaged or something that you just don't see it or
absolutely.
Maybe they're trying to hide it. I mean, that's something that, you know, you talked about that it's not always hidden, but sometimes it is, right? Sometimes right. the right. offenders are putting things in secret places or they're hiding it in false, you know, doors or whatever it is. So that it is sometimes hidden, but sometimes people are trying and they just don't see it. And this is the wonderful thing is this dog doesn't care. This dog, she doesn't care if, you know, this guy has the nicest house or the grossest house. She is just there to sniff for these things and it's all work for her.
Exactly, because she wants the food.
Yeah, exactly. And, yep. It's reward based, food based, and I'm telling you, if I had not witnessed this myself on dozens and dozens of occasions, I could see someone being like, what, how do you sniff out an electronic or whatever? And there's all kinds of stuff behind it. And we would love to have Jeff come on at some point to sort of break all that down. And maybe we can con him into doing that.
When he retires.
But at the end of the day, it's very effective. So like if you're a listener and you're envisioning, you know, 15 cops and agents and evidence people on a scene of a home that's going to be searched. And we spend all this time and, you know, six of us separately have gone through or in teams of two and searched this particular area. And we feel pretty confident that, you know, hey, we're pretty sure we got everything.
Oh, and then you leave. She can embarrass you quickly.
Yeah. Because the 100%, dog, yeah. Yes. Cause the dog goes in after everybody has searched and done what they've done. And so you feel pretty confident when you're in that room, you're like, no, nah, I know we got it all. I got it all. And then he comes out.
And this is a secret that I'm going to give away is Jen is wonderful. Cause she loves to show when the dog finds something that people didn't, she's like, oh, you missed this.
Yeah. Because when he walks out with the dog and he's feeding the dog, and then you're like, uh-oh. And then it's like, did he find anything? And Jen's like, yeah, here's a bag with six SD cards. Here are the 15 things that
she found.
Yeah, she found all these things, and everybody's like defeated. You're like, what? Where was that?
That's what we need to know, because we need to be aware of that asset, because I, sitting here today, can speak that there are victims out there that if it wasn't for Iris, we would have never found.
Yeah, 100%.
So under that, it's an asset that's available. And I would never run a warrant without her.
Which is a liaison thing, right? Like that's a federal partnership where you partner with your agency, or your agency partners with federal agencies. And then you're having those open lines of communication where you're saying, hey, what can we use for this? Because ultimately it is the rescue of a child.
Correct. Yep.
And so why would you miss it for nothing?
I know it doesn't have to be just a child. I know they've had major cases where that involved cryptocurrency and stuff that was hidden. And, you know, if you've got a case that involves electronics, that's basically behind your case, utilize an electronic detection canine. Yeah. Like
it's just a tool on the tool belt. Correct. It really is. It's just a tool. It's just knowing where to access that tool. And if you work in an agency and you're reluctant to build a relationship with the federal partners in your area, these are things you're missing out on, because you know what it costs your agency to get that dog who comes from another state? $0. Because you have that relationship with the feds. The feds already requisition, I guess, funds and approvals and all this, because that's the functionality of this tool. And it just happens to be a pretty damn good tool and a very effective tool. And as a result, real kids have been saved and real kids have been rescued.
Legit. I mean, you can't talk about the cases, I know, but there have been kids rescued from the use of this asset.
Absolutely.
Which is also happens to be a really cute little puppy.
Oh, she's gorgeous.
And she's sweet. So, okay. So I know we're going to talk about a case on next week's episode with Jen, because she's going to come back and talk about a case. But I want to talk for a minute about our favorite Jennifer stories. I don't think we've actually done this episode, but one of my favorite memories, she's retired now. So we've got, you know, we didn't have an official like sit and tell story. So this is it. Every cop Tony and I know that we work with has Jennifer stories because they love Jennifer. And so one of the ones that I'm going to talk about this case in upcoming episodes, but I remember we're waiting on one of the suspects to show up for a meeting that he set with what he thinks is a kid. And you can tell your perspective, but I just remember Jen's in the back of the car where we're waiting, and we're all like surveillanced out and we're looking for this guy and we're all pins and needles waiting. And she's back there furiously typing, and she's typing a warrant so that if he shows up, we have a reason to hold him and take him federal. And what was that perspective for you? You're just typing away in the back and people think, oh, what's she doing here? And
so this is one of the keys where I wish Brandon would have brought me in earlier on the investigation.
Oh my gosh. I tell this funny story that's talking about your feverish work ethic and I get thrown under the bus.
So he brings me in on this investigation. I don't know how long you'd been doing it. And so I am loaded down with chat communications and I'm writing the warrant, trying to write the story.
Probably about months of chat, right?
Probably. Tried, and I think it was a special application that he transitioned the child to. Yeah. And so I'm having to describe the months-long chat, the application, everything up to the meet that day. And I'm furiously typing because, of course, if he shows up, I want to arrest him.
Right.
And he showed up.
He showed up, and she got to effect an arrest on him, and that typing
is not
was
correct. I stayed in the back seat of the car typing
right.
when everybody else bails out of the car.
Well, we effected an arrest, and she typed the ability to hold him legally.
And I'm sitting in the back seat of the car going, Brandon, is it him? Is it him? Did he show up? Because I'm typing, wanting to write that so-and-so showed up.
Is it him? I do remember she's like huddled in the back seat with computers and paperwork, and she's like, is it him? Did he show up? Is it him? And I'm like, yes,
because
he showed
up. A different car. He showed up in a different car than what we were expecting. So I didn't know if it was him who we thought it was. Yes, I remember that. That's
we.
Crazy.
I have other ones. I know we did tell and we told. I think we did this the episode, and I don't remember the number of the ER supervisor that we arrested. He was a nurse supervisor.
Oh yeah. I don't remember what episode that was.
But I will say that. Well, I don't know if I want to tell exactly what you said, but Jen was a little enamored with him.
His voice.
He said that voice.
She sat in the back seat while we're taking him into custody, and she just asked him random questions, right?
I don't remember what questions. I just wanted to hear him talk.
You know, it's the worst day in the life ever. Of this poor individual. And she's like, I just love his voice, Brandon.
He did. He had an amazing voice.
Oh, what's your favorite?
There's too many to even mention, but there's so many. Like, there'd be times when, it might be last minute. Hey, Jen, I got this dude showing up. Can you come up here? And so she'd just hop in the truck and, like, you know, just in case a phone call, something, whatever, like, we'd sit up for sometimes hours. Very rarely did we get stood up, but a couple times for the short term we got stood up. But oh my gosh, there's so many dang stories.
I think my most favorite one is y'all were teaching somewhere. And you were bringing a traveler in.
Yeah, we were in California.
And he calls me and says, what you doing? And I was like, sitting at my desk. And then he explains to me, I might have somebody coming in. I forgot
what
you're
not there
PD
to deal with it.
Well, the PD was tied up on something. He's like, can you go help out? And I was like, sure.
Yeah, 100%. We were actually in Cali teaching. And, we had a whole group of law enforcement there that was doing what we were training to do. And in that process, we continue doing our normal things that we normally do in an undercover capacity. And I just was hitting it up with this dude, and he was dead set. He was coming. And I, at first I just sort of dismissed it, think, cause they all sort of say that. But then he actually took a picture of the intersection
That's
of where
it, yep.
the meet would have taken place. He's like, oh, look right here. I'm right here. And I'm like, oh, snap.
He's
and,
there.
And I'm like, I'm calling the boss and I'm calling Jen. I was like, I need a favor. And that one turned out pretty well. I think I don't know if we talked about it or not, that particular case, but
probably not because I don't think it's because we adopted it federally.
Right. Yeah.
So I think it's still going through the system.
Right.
Now.
But I remember sitting in a hotel lobby for about 5.5 hours near Christmas time, waiting to seize. Oh, did that just remember? You just flashback,
yes,
waiting to seize a phone from a suspect. And I tell you what, we're sitting there talking, and I was like, I can't imagine what people are thinking that we're doing here at this hotel. Probably need to call my wife and tell her that nothing shady's going on here.
I remember that.
A very nice hotel.
It was a very nice hotel.
You guys
hotel.
Were sending me text messages and pictures of these like super nice. I'm like, where the hell are you guys? Like,
weird chairs. So we're sitting in all the different weird chairs taking pictures. We were working.
And then I swear, I think Jen thought I was going to have to fight that person for the phone because I had to sort of get a little bit strict to get that phone. So we have a lot of fun stories with Jennifer. We're going to come back and tell one of her favorite cases. Maybe not favorite, but it's a good one. We're going to talk about what she did sort of the last few years of her career and now what she's doing now that she's blissfully retired. So thank you for sticking with us. Join us next week as we talk to Jennifer again.
All right. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Catfish Cops podcast, brought to you by Brandon Poor and Tony Godwin. For additional information and available resources, please visit our website, www.catfishcops.com, and click on the resources link.